Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
zombie myths of Australian military history. Sorry, I'm probably going to be drowned out by, or I don't know, it looks like 10 kookaburras in the tree next door. That's getting all this territorialism there, protecting their territory, which I suppose is the idea of the military. But this is the last epilogue. We've had 10 grueling chapters. Thank you for being with me for them. Many people who have actually kicked on it as soon as it's come up. The computer has fallen apart and uploading it. Much to my surprise, it's taken on its life as its own. I've got enough monitoring, preparing software to actually pick up if there's a problem and it reloads it. So I know it's had a problem getting it up there, but I don't know what the problem is. I know it's off solving it. This is the software I've got to upload my podcasts, and I've actually gone through, this is quite actually a little journey for me that you've shared with me, you people in podcast land, as I've read. Initially it was supplying missing information for me, or the sort of the shock, or there was information, it was important, and it was, you know, vital for me to form a more balanced opinion, or a nuanced perspective, like the occupation of Australia by the British, the double crossing associated with that, the fakeness of, the phoniness of the fraud of Breaker Moran, the various death throes of World War One, in this sort of stupidity and futility of the Gallipoli campaign, the fantasy of Australians actually winning World War One single-handedly almost, and then a series of misconceptions held about how great we were in World War Two. And this is trying to strike a delicate balance for those people who seize the high ground, sort of the high ground of remembrance and culture, but are not necessarily the best custodians of it. And then the Vietnam era, the fact that it's increasingly, as it gets closer, you can see how the myths entangle and actually trip up well-intentioned, rational caring. Essentially, what we want to do is we want to care for everyone in our community and care for our vets. And the fact that the vet movement got sort of sidelined and followed into the US veteran movement actually began chasing up in the wrong directions and actually not helping the vets as much as they could possibly do. It's also interesting to read about the differences between the RSL and the VAA, the veterans, Vietnam's veterans, and how they've sort of split in separate directions. And yes, they've gone in separate directions, but now we're so many years afterwards, things should not merge together, but become coalesced. I don't know how to describe it. Then, of course, chapter 10 was the shock that I've been lied to personally about Timor. The Indonesians were conducting ethnic cleansing, and we had some sort of deal with, high-level deal with Indonesia, that we actually, conspired with the Indonesians for ethnic cleansing. So this is sort of like, this is horrid. To think that our country actually supported the Indonesians in ethnic cleansing of this minority. Or they weren't a minority, they were the majority. They were ethnic cleansing of a region. And thereby you say, well, perhaps there's other areas that Indonesia's not so hot and good at. But the real horror, that in order to that to go ahead, it wasn't Australia as a whole, but it was the sort of administration of Australia and the Indonesian administration working together against really the people of East Timor, and actually against the actual will and core values of Australia. Jeez, that's just big news. It's a lot to stomach. And so it was a bit of a surprise for me, sort of, to work my way through a book. And the only reason I'm working my way through a book podcasting, quite frankly, is to get my cognitive skills up, to get back on the horse. It may be a different horse I'm able to mount. You're probably able to ride a thoroughbred now. I'm sort of getting back on my Shetland pony, going all together. And so this is the epilogue. And again, I'm beginning to be able to read as I'm reading, start to scan a paragraph ahead and pick things up. So that's good, but I haven't read these ahead. So it's sometimes when I read things that start me thinking, I get actually a bit confused as I'm reading. So I'm reading one thought and having another thought at the same time. It's a bit hard for me. So let's read this. Returning zombies to their graves. So these are things which do not live on facts. They live on a dark, mesmeric, bad air in Australian society, feeding off people who would be leaders. This is just, just an astonishing thing. Okay, let's read this here. These chapters are merely a sample of the zombie myths associated with Australian military history. Well, they're not a sample. I think they're a dissection. This list is not exhaustive. There are, of course, fables left untouched and conflicts left uncovered. Ongoing military commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan are two notable cases in point. They may well take a few more years for the zombies of the Middle East to emerge, but rest assured they will arise. As long as so much modern-day Australian nationalism, sense of self and collective identity, is sourced from the imagery of past conflicts, we will continue to draw what we need from the past without worrying too much about the factual accounts. Isn't this powerful writing? If our late 20th century and early 21st century social consciences requires us to forget that white settlers invaded this country, that we will conclude there was no war of occupation. When we feel anxious about the fading ties with traditional material and cultural allies, such as the British Empire in the context of the popular war in Vietnam, then we will invent characters like the Breaker. Gee whiz, that's awful. Yeah, which is what I've said before. If we feel something positive must come from the bloodletting such as Gallipoli and the war on the Western Front, which was supposed to have baptized this country into community of nations, then the August offensive of 1915 must have been a near-run thing, or at least the very failure was surely the fault of the British. And Imperial Germany must have been, in the end, broken by the indomitable spirit of the Australian infantrymen. This is just a summary of these lies which exist in Australia. No Australian could ever have died in vain. Forced to deal once more with the shock of tremendous loss of World War II, the reality of the conflict on our doorstep, and the uncertainty of race and culture in the white outpost of a nation coming to terms with its geographical reality, Australian ethnicity was again the key to martial success. The application of such traits at places like Kokoda Trail saved the day, or our very hearths and homes. And where we faced old-fashioned defeat, even in a single naval action such as which sank the HMS Sydney, there must be some conspiracy or other nefarious force at play. It could not simply be a case of war's grim harvest. They were Australians. Isn't that beautiful? War's grim harvest. This person is a poet. Look at this, war's grim harvest. What's this person on? He's fantastic. I wish I could say. I wish I could actually speak and produce this type of wording. Perhaps if I upload myself with sufficient reading. So that's what's happening. Oh, you can't tell it, but I can tell cognitively. I'm sort of slowly reconnecting the neural pathways here. Even remembering things, remembering where I'm on a page is a big feat. In the case of the former, oh, sorry. As I say that, I remember on my page, I missed the point I'm on the page. In more recent times, nagging, if often indefinable feeling of uneasiness or even guilt about military commitments to Vietnam or else a lack of Australian action with respect to the fate of East Timor up to 1999 has spawned their own set of fables. In the case of the former Vietnam, most concerned the uniqueness of the conflict from the conduct of the war as to the impact on veterans. In the case of the latter is, amongst other images, the picture of a paternalistic Australia saviour. I don't think that's... I think this is just of a... I think it's almost like child abuse. Just... It's awful. I'll put it in the same level as that. It's, obviously, it's a different thing, but it's just awful. It's like a paedophile ring or a genocide ring. It's awful. There is no doubt that all such myths fulfill a social need. That they are untrue is largely beside the point in this regard. But they are false, and we should not forget it. Such ideas are historical fiction. They are not history. As far as the authors of this book are concerned, accuracy, impartiality, attempts at rational objectivity, what might be called the searches for truth, do matter. They are important. They mean something worthwhile. They fill a social need as well, perhaps an even higher one. Isn't it beautiful? Myths are social need, but we've got a greater need for truth. I think we've got to go with here. It's important to once again acknowledge that the whole issue of historical myth-making regarding military heritage of this country is complicated by a natural founding story, the idea of the Anzac. Well, there's also the founding of Australia, which is another myth. Was not a myth, but an absolute construction. Like most national myths, Anzac is based on inspiring narratives, concepts and images about our country's past. It serves as an important unifying representation. It affirms a set of self-perceived national values. It contains a symbolic meaning and has only served social and political purposes. In some respects, Anzac even fulfills a secular religious function. Importantly, it is based on, but not necessarily reflect, historical fact. Anzac involves fictionalized exaggerations of actual incidents, commonly disregards inconvenient historical details, and in some ways subverts or reinvents the past to fit legend. Prior to 1914, Australians saw themselves as part of the mighty British Empire. And we're proud of that fact. Concepts of Australian nationhood were complicated by shared imperial heritage and strong continuing connections. Moreover, too many early 20th century Australians, their country still lacked one key experience which to that generation mattered above all others. Australia had not yet, as a nation, faced the trial by arms. As noted specifically in Chapter 5, simultaneously as Australia learned of the tragedy of the loss of life in the events unfolding in the Dardanelles in 1915, so too they were told such bloodletting had forged their nation's rite of passage into the international community. Their country had passed the test. At the same time, deeds at Gallipoli and later Flanders and Palestine filled the vacuum for the newborn nation. As part of the emerging Australian national consciousness, the interwar period saw the glorification of material achievements of the newly returned servicemen. In the 20s and 30s, the idea of the Anzac also became to represent a distinct collection of social values embodying perceived comradeship of frontline soldiers, a rejection of conventional discipline, physical strength, egalitarianism, loyalty, self-sacrifice, courage, and early 20th century Australian conceptions of masculinity. The myth remains centred on success, not defeat. Even at the genesis, a marked strategic failure like Gallipoli was redefined to be understood as a triumph of endurance and celebration of Australian virtues. Yeah. And I suppose the thing that shocks me is the limited size of Gallipoli. It was just such a small campaign area. I'm looking around here at Blue Mountains. You can hear the trucks rushing past from the freeway where I'm sitting on a log overlooking overlooking Glenbrook, but truly, it's, I don't know whether you can visually see Lone Pine from Gallipoli Breach, but there's something not impossible. It was certainly no large range conflict as we can see. The idea of Anzac consciously and subconsciously permeated all aspects of community and social life, and traditionally came to represent a central aspect of Australian identity. Anzac centred in the lexicon of everyday language. Its imagery was carved in stone in monuments across the nation. Its ideas were celebrated with reverence each year on April in commemoration of the original Gallipoli landing, and its history settled into school curriculums, you betcha. It came impossible to escape the mist, and it still is. Anzac is, in fact, getting stronger. The number of politicians invoking terms to hit the social chord bound to reverberate. The size of Anzac Day marches despite the dwindling number of traditional veterans and number of Australians on annual pilgrimages to Anzac Coves. Flag in hand, draped over their shoulders, is evidence enough of this. The authors of this book recognised from the very beginning that the subjects under discussion and their conclusions might set them in a collision course with the Anzac legend in the minds of many readers. At one level, we embrace the legend should not substitute for history. But the legend should not. It is a myth, however powerful and pervasive. It is obscured more about the past than it has revealed. Beautiful. But at another level, this collision is entirely unnecessary. We are historians. We do not seek to undermine some of the foundation stones of the Anzac for the pleasure of appearing subversives. Nor do we reject the idea that some social good can flow from the Anzac legend, despite the exclusive nature of the white, Anglo-Saxon male and macho orientation. All we ask is that the legend not be mistaken for history. We lay some zombie myths to rest, and they deserve it. They have been walking the land and living on our soul for too long, living for too long. Beautiful writing. Let us conclude by remembering one particular and important point, noted in the introduction of this book. These pages have covered a number of key issues of Australian military history. The authors have applied analytical torch to the subjects more used to veneration and commemoration than to rigorous analysis. In terms of military history, critiquing a misinterpretation is not the same as criticising the participants. We do not minimise, undermine or forget the sacrifices made by Australian servicemen and women of the years. On the contrary, we honour them, with an objective recognition of their deeds. We honour them as rational, reflective people, free of pursuit, interference and befuddlement by the zombie myths of the past. Surely they are worthy of us that much. Individuals accomplished in the words of C.E.W. Bean's words. Now, this is C.W. Bean is the sort of the zombie master. So let's see what he has to say. Nothing now can alter the good and the bad, the greatness and the smallest of their stories will stand. Whatever of glory it contains, nothing it can now lessen. It rises as it will always rise above the mists of ages. A monument to the great-hearted man, and for their nation, a possession forever. Isn't it a beautiful book? Well, thanks a lot for listening as we progress along this path. Podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.